Welcome to the Consumer Insights Podcast. Every episode, we speak with an insights leader in one of the world's leading brands to hear how they're integrating consumer insights into strategy to move business forward. I'm your host, Thor Olav Filogen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Consumer Insights Podcast. Today, I'm super excited to have an incredible insights leader joining me for what I know will be a great conversation. Rogier Verhulst has more than 20 years of experience in data analysis and market research, working for agency and client-side organizations such as WPP and Microsoft. But currently, he's the head of market research at LinkedIn, a strong advocate of turning complex data into simple and compelling stories. Rogier has co-authored a textbook, The Business of Marketing Research, providing a highly practical approach to market research. Rogier, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Thor. It's really a pleasure to be here today, and hopefully I can say some interesting things to your audience. Looking forward to getting into it.
But let's get to know you first, Rogier. So firstly, could you take a couple of minutes to tell us a bit about yourself, your journey, and how you came to work in the role you're in today? How did it all start?
Yeah, I was born and raised in the Netherlands. I grew up in the era when the internet really started to take off. I finished my degree in economics from Tilburg University in the Netherlands, and then soon found that I really had a passion for kind of research and you know, great curiosity. And so I really enjoyed that process of researching. And then at the same time, you know, seeing the internet sort of take off, the two factors sort of led me to Silicon Valley, if you will. And you know, I wanted to be part of that sort of first initial dot-com boom. And I saw all these companies sort of exploding, if you will, and large and small companies really jumping on the internet and what was possible. And so picked up my suitcases, and rather than starting at a boring bank in the Netherlands, I jumped on a plane and went to San Francisco. And part of that is also my nature. I tend to be fairly independent and chart my own course. And so I didn't want to sort of fit a particular mold. Went out there, and I had some connections in San Francisco from my professor who made a move there as well, who had a good relationship with. And so he invited me to come work at a market research agency. Yeah, and so did a lot of work for large and smaller companies at the time to help them understand how to sort of capitalize on the internet. And sort of working at the agency in the early days really gave me a great sort of foundational understanding of research methodologies and what you can do to solve problems for companies large and small. And I really enjoyed that time being in San Francisco at the time. We started to develop as an agency, we started to develop a good relationship with Microsoft at the time as well. And after having worked at the agency for a few years, I made the jump over to Microsoft and worked in their central market research group for a number of years. And that was a great experience too, because it helped allow me to understand kind of how a big corporation is operating and how to navigate the complexities of larger organizations and, you know, having to influence people at different levels in the organization. So, and really that's a big part of being an insights professional is to take your insights and getting other people to take action on it. And so that gave me a really good understanding of how to communicate and how to report insights in a way that's most compelling back to your stakeholders. You know, after having done that for a few years, I sort of got the 4-year itch. And so in 2008, that's at the time when kind of the Web 2.0 movement started. And so you saw a lot of like companies starting to realize that when you create social networks, you create networks, you can build all kinds of interesting solutions on top of that. And many companies didn't quite know how to make money off that, but it was a really interesting concept to connect people on the internet and to stay connected through them, through these networks. And so LinkedIn was about to take off at that time. I always wanted to work at a startup, and I think that felt like that was the right time for me to make that move and join LinkedIn when it was still fairly small and we didn't really know what businesses we should be building. And so when I started, it was really about helping them build a B2B sample business and essentially become a resource to the research community or to hedge funds to provide expert access or expert, you know, create an expert network, if you will. And so it was really interesting to kind of build that business from the ground up within a smaller startup. And this was just one of many sort of things that Reid Hoffman wanted to pursue I mean, his philosophy was very much around like, let's plant lots of seeds and see what ultimately grows into a big flower. Obviously, it was an interesting experience, but we quickly realized, even though we were pretty successful, there wasn't going to be a massive business. And so we abandoned that business. And I think that was really good at that time for the company to do, to just say like, look, we've got all these other things going on. Let's just really double down the things that we believe are going to turn into billion-dollar markets. And so they sort of gave up on that concept and then started to build kind of the talent solutions business and marketing solutions business and the sales solutions businesses. And so we started to use our capabilities that we built and use them more for internal purposes. So that also gave me then a chance to do something different within the company. And, you know, one of the things in the early days that we recognized is like, people didn't really understand the solutions that we were trying to build. And in many cases, we're trying to revolutionize sort of existing industries. Like if you think of the hiring industry up until LinkedIn came around, was very much based on post and pay. I mean, you went to monster.com as a company, you posted a job and then you just waited for people to apply to it. And whereas we were trying to come at it from a very different angle, which is to say, we provide you solutions and tools that allow you to access a big network of people so that you can actually proactively reach out to candidates that may be a little bit passive for any of the jobs that you're trying to fill. And so that was a very novel concept, but it required a lot of like education and insights as well to sort of drive the sales behind that. So it allowed me to learn a lot about kind of how you query databases, how you use data, you extract data, and then turn it into insights, essentially in the beginning, really to help support the growth of the business and sort of we coined the term data-driven sales at the time, but also allowed me to see different aspects of the business. From there, I took a stint in product and product management, product operations, and so got to experience that aspect as well. And then ultimately, when the company started to become bigger and bigger in 2016, there was a realization that we needed to get more serious about just creating more formalized groups that do very formalized work. And at that time, we started to have a pretty large group of customers. And so one of the things that we want to understand is just like, how satisfied are they with our solutions and how much loyalty are we creating? And so the company started to ask sort of the more bigger company type questions that then required us to create more of a formalized market research group. And so in 2016, I sort of founded the research function at LinkedIn. And ever since I've been doing that. And so it really kind of came full circle, if you will, because that's how I started out the agency side and ultimately got the chance at LinkedIn to sort of develop that function. So that's been my journey so far, and I'm really enjoying it. The team right now, we started with a small group of people and we're at 40 people now. We're a centralized function. We support all of the market research for the company, the exception of UXR. That's a very specialized field. So we work very closely with those folks as well within the company and I'm having a great time. And I remain very bullish on LinkedIn. I think the mission vision is very strong. The culture they've created is something that's really long lasting, and people tend to stick around and learn quite a bit as well from people that are fairly experienced and kind of know what they're doing. But yeah, I've been really enjoying it so far, and I continue to enjoy it. And I think my motivations for continuing to be in this field is just to really advance the field and promote the field of market research and consumer insights, because I think it is a really important function in any company.
This is such a fascinating journey that you've had to get to where you are today. And I would agree, you know, even from the outside, I think LinkedIn is an amazing company and definitely I'm impressed by it. But let's dig maybe a little deeper about the function that you founded. And I know you've worked at LinkedIn for more than 13 years now, across a variety of different roles, as you pointed out. But what really strikes me as super interesting for our listeners is how much LinkedIn has grown and evolved since you joined, right? So could you tell us how it was like setting up that insights department in the earlier stages of LinkedIn?
Yeah, I mean, I was obviously very privileged to see the entire evolution or close to the entire evolution of the company. And when we started, it was just a few hundred people. And today we're close to 20,000 people. But in the early days, I think research and insights was really primarily used to drive that education awareness of, you know, what we were trying to achieve. And as I mentioned earlier, like really try to help customers understand what their footprint already was on LinkedIn and how they could take advantage of that footprint they already had on LinkedIn. They had a company page, employees were on LinkedIn, and how to turn that into an asset, whether they were trying to promote their company or whether they were trying to hire people, attract talent, or whether they were trying to advertise themselves. And so But that required quite a bit of convincing that they should be investing in LinkedIn. They should be buying ads. They should be buying our solutions to help them hire the best talents. And so we used the focus was really on building kind of the platforms and getting the insights out. In many ways with LinkedIn, the product that LinkedIn is at the end of the day is data. And data is sort of the currency that flows through the entire economy. And so we coined the phrase of the economic graph. Like we have this economic graph of where you have members, you have customers, you have companies, you have universities, you have all kinds of nodes in their graph. And we're trying to connect those and then have the capital sort of flow effectively through that graph. But to sort of visualize that and make that clear, you actually need quite a bit of insights. And that's what we really focused on. And one of the cool things I think we developed sort of early on was these insights that were fairly unique that the world hadn't seen and weren't unable to see up until that point. So we created things like talent flows. Like we were able to see which companies were hiring and which companies were losing talent. But more importantly, we were able to see who they were losing talent to or who they were gaining talent from. And so these were very powerful ways for executives at corporations to see where the attrition issues were, where the retention challenges were. And that's just one example of insights that we could bring to the table, or understanding kind of how the talent is distributed across the country or the world, right? Where are the people with specific skill sets? Are they concentrated in certain areas? And so as a hiring professional, if you try to go after talent, like where should you be looking? And so all of that required quite a bit of insights. And so it was a really exciting time to be part of that. But everything happened sort of haphazardly as well, because you can imagine the data only got more interesting as the network started to grow. And so what was possible in 2008 was little compared to what's possible today, as the penetration of LinkedIn is so high in so many different markets today. Particularly internationally, that's where we get most of our engagement from these days, versus in the beginning, it was mostly from the US. So, but yeah, I mean, obviously, even a smaller company, things happen very haphazardly and there's hypergrowth and there's no always rhyme or reason to things. But it was a very exciting time. And so, yeah, that's how the company has evolved, obviously, is from kind of a smaller company to a bigger company where you have more formalization.
I mean, having been through that journey is, of course, fascinating, because you've really been able to do many more things with the data as the company's grown bigger, of course, and that graph has expanded. But I'm also curious to understand how the way you work with market research and insights in general has changed as the company have grown.
In the early days, we had a very short-term focus, and it was very much focused on what do we need to know in the next 30 days to make a decision, versus doing research that helps us understand maybe what's going to happen in 2 years from now, or build a strategy for the next 2 years. And so I think as we got bigger and bigger, you know, you're going to start to add more process, you have more formalized roles and more organization. And so we obviously, when you get to a certain stage, you go from a few thousand customers to tens of thousands of customers to you start to lose kind of sight of, there's always a risk and an understanding of, like, you start to kind of get further removed from, like, how do customers actually really feel about you? And as you start to create products that become like that from when you launch in year one to two, three, and four, you start to also hit different types of customers that, you know, the early adopters from more of the customers that are a little bit more conservative, but have different needs. And I think you start to see that get a little bit more attrition, customers are maybe not renewing as much. And so then you start to ask as an organization different kinds of questions. It kind of moves from where can we grow and market penetration to more questions around, like, how can we retain customers, or how can we grow share wallet with existing customers? And then naturally then will lead to how satisfied are they, or how loyal are they? And so you start to do more of the research that's more kind of the basics of what you see in larger companies as well, of like typical CSAT or NPS type research as sort of a basis and foundation. And then from there, you know, it's like new product innovation, and you become a little bit more deliberate about how you think about these decisions, because suddenly now you're talking about products that are $1 billion products versus products that started off the 100,000s range. And then you need to be much more careful about that next feature you're launching or that next product you're trying to build. The risk suddenly becomes so much higher, right? You're starting now to make not $1 million decisions, but now you're making $1 billion decisions. And so I think the organization recognizes that at that point, it's probably important that you have a little bit more intelligence behind the decisions you're making. And so that's how I think the insights function has sort of changed over time, is that as the stakes go higher, there's more emphasis on investing in teams and doing the right sort of approaches to understand that you're making the right calls. And so you then start to hire more sort of people with a specific background. And as the company becomes bigger, then you also now you have competition. And so you need to understand the competitive landscape, but you also need to understand kind of how your positioning compares to others out there. And you start to invest a lot more in branding and marketing and then understanding the brand perceptions. And you start doing advertising, start spending money there. So then you need to understand how effective that spend is. And then you need to do research around that. So that's kind of how I see the evolution of, like, we're doing, quite frankly, things more on like gut instinct and intuition with a few hundred customers, to becoming much more data-driven and scientific about what you do when you have thousands and thousands of customers. And obviously you have the means then to tap into a much larger collective group of customers and get more sort of wisdom from a larger crowd.
I think that makes a lot of sense. But let's get back to basics here for a second. As an insights leader, how do you define an insight?
For me, an insight is kind of a deep intuitive understanding about a group of people or a thing, but it needs to be based on a fact or a data point. Now, what I see a lot of people confuse or getting confused is, like, they say, they talk about data, but really they mean insights, or they equate data with insights. And I think those are two different things. Data in and of itself, in my mind, is not an insight. And there's this really famous quote, "God we trust, all others bring data." But in my mind, it should be, "In God we trust and all others bring insights." But the point is that data only is as good as the data you have. And there needs to be an element of, when you don't have the data, there needs to be an element of intuition that you have to bring to the table. You have to use sort of common sense or judgment to fill in some of these blanks, and recognizing that you can't always have perfect data of everything. And so that's why I make distinction between data and insights. But it is really important, because insights, to me, that defines insight as something that's a little bit a mix or blend of what I'm observing, what the facts are, plus what my judgment or intuition is around those particular data points, that ultimately then gives you that deep understanding that you then need to make a decision. And that's also what I think is important about insight. Insights naturally needs to give you an idea of what the next step should be. Like, what should I do based on this particular insight? And if we can't articulate that, then it's not, in my mind, an insight.
I just love the way you use the word intuition. I just love the way how you bring that idea of actually looking at it as a puzzle and then understanding how they fit together. And maybe if we spend a bit more time on that, and maybe you could give me a couple of examples, actual live examples from your time at LinkedIn, when you and your team have integrated an insight that has fueled innovation or perhaps allowed you to build a better product, better project. And walk us through the whole flow. You know, what was the insight that created the opportunity? How did you identify the insight? You know, what was the end result? Walk us through that.
Yeah. So I think one of the things early on in LinkedIn's trajectory, we were really focused on selling into large enterprises. And we believe that the early members that joined LinkedIn tended to come from enterprises. But what we quickly started to notice is that as the network started to grow, we didn't have a lot of participation from smaller businesses, particularly on the B2B space, who weren't as penetrated as we should be in the small business. And that could have been part of the function of how we evolved and grew. But we didn't quite understand, like, why wouldn't they participate in this economic graph as strongly as the larger enterprises? And so the executive team asked us some very specific questions around that. And we did our research, and we initially started doing kind of social listening, because the challenge was we didn't have small businesses on LinkedIn, and the ones that were on LinkedIn were a little bit atypical. So we didn't have a great sort of source to tap into. But what we did have is the internet at large. And so understanding small businesses at the internet at large and sort of listening organically to the conversations that are happening was a very powerful way for us to understand, okay, what are the challenges that they're having? What are the pain points they're having when it comes to starting a business or growing a business? And it helped us sort of map out, in kind of the conversation that's happening on the internet at large, by listening to specific forums or going to specific sites that we knew SMBs were attending, we were starting to get a pretty good sense of what kind of their challenges are. And then we sort of did some soul searching to understand, okay, what do we have today? What are the assets we've created today? And how are we maybe not addressing those challenges and pain points that those SMBs are seeing that then led to particular insights and opportunities? And we also learned throughout that process. And so we did social listening. We also did depth interviews. We did qualitative and then quantitative research ultimately to verify whether the challenge and pain points sort of by and large sort of applied to a large set of SMBs. But what we learned is that they had sort of this misconception that LinkedIn was just for large enterprises. So it wasn't a place where they belonged or where they felt like they should be. But on the same token, they also felt like they saw the opportunity. They saw the possibilities of, and they saw their customers and prospects on LinkedIn and the companies they wanted to sell into. When we started sort of mapping out the challenges, we started mapping out the opportunity. We started to understand what was missing in our own product. When we started to bring all of those views together, it started to lead to some really powerful insights around what we needed to do. We also discovered, for example, that they were using a personal profile. So oftentimes they did have a profile on LinkedIn. They just didn't have their company sort of represented well, but they would use their personal profile to sort of promote the company at the same time. And so that led us to build pages that were more geared towards, so company pages that were more geared towards communicating what their brand or their company stood for. And from there, we started to also understand that one of the biggest challenges they have is just growing the business and connecting them to potential prospects. And so we started to build features and functionality that allow them to launch campaigns straight from their pages. So all of that was based on some of the rich insights that we uncovered through all of the work and the research we were doing. But a lot of it also just came down to voice and tone and just shifting the perceptions. So it led to a lot of like understanding of how we needed to talk to them and how we needed to address them. I mean, a lot of these small businesses were very stressed, were very strapped for time. And so, but we needed to strike a much more empathetic tone in how we sort of talked and communicated to them. And so all of that was based on all the rich insights that we were able to glean through a number of different ways of looking at the problem.
I think this is so fascinating, you know, knowing how powerful the product is today and seeing how what you just described enabled you to develop the product into what it is today is just fascinating. And I also love the fact that you talked about soul searching, because you talked about the researcher as a human being and always also talking about that empathetic tone. So let's dig a bit deeper into this. And I've listened to a couple of your previous interviews, and I've really enjoyed how you've previously talked about looking at problems holistically. And I think it ties to what you just said. You've talked about tackling the so what and the now what together. Could you maybe give our listeners a bit more about that approach that you follow here?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of hypothesis-based approaches and issue trees. I think a lot of research fails because we were failing to understand the exact problem we're trying to solve. And I don't think a lot of practitioners spend enough time in the problem space, really truly articulating what is it specifically what the problem is. And oftentimes that's kind of a why question or a how question. But you need to bring the whole organization together before you start your research to try and understand, okay, what do we already know about this? What is the fundamental issue that we're trying to solve? What's really interesting about that process or step is that oftentimes you'll find that people really can't quite articulate the problem well enough. I mean, it will go something along the lines of, we want more small businesses. It's like, okay, well, why do you want more businesses, right? Because we want to get more revenue. We want to grow the business. It's like, okay, why do you want to grow the business? And so you start to sort of dig deeper and deeper into what the core problems are. But once you have the different problems and the different hypotheses, and then you can build out this whole sort of tree, right? And it's where there's a lot of divergent thinking that goes on in terms of like, well, I think, you know, the reason that small businesses aren't on LinkedIn is because they're just not aware of LinkedIn And so you can build out that whole issue tree or that branch of the tree. And then, you know, well, why are they, or they may be on LinkedIn, but they're just not engaging very well. Well, maybe the reason is that we just haven't got a good product market fit with them, right? Maybe our pricing is too high. And so you start to sort of unpack what the problem is, but then leads to a set of statements that then you can go research. And then some of these statements you can say, well, we already have this data. We don't need to do more new research, or we can get this from this study we did last year, to then kicking off what needs to be net new research to then fill in the gaps. And I think when you take that kind of approach and you look back at what you get back, it's kind of garbage in, garbage out. If you don't do that really well, then you get garbage. But if you do that really well, then you get insights back that are now neatly tied to the issues that you were trying to address or the hypothesis you were trying to test. And it gives you then a set of very clear so what's, right? Where you can almost write the executive summary before you even start the research project, where each of the issues or each of the branches in the tree become kind of your headline or your bullets. And that then leads to very specific actions of what the company needs to do to address those. And so that's how I get to sort of the so what and the know what. And you spend a lot of time, obviously, fine-tuning that, making sure that you really are clear on what it all means and what the implications are. And you need to spend quite a bit of time there. And then you need to spend quite a bit of time making sure you internalize and bring the whole organization along so they really truly understand what it means and what they need to go do next. So that's kind of the approach that I've been promoting quite a bit. I talk a lot about this in the whole section in the book as well that talks about this approach and how you can apply it. But I think it is something that gets overlooked quite a bit, unfortunately, the world of research.
I think it's really powerful. I think it's a very crisp message. And now that you've given us some advice on how to think to support a successful market and, you know, research and insight strategy, could you also share some tools and some tooling that you believe is essential?
Yeah, I mean, I think about tools along kind of three categories. I think there are tools for exploration. So these are the tools that you use once you have your data set. These are the tools you use to sort of explore and interrogate the data, if you will. And so obviously you have the historical packages like SPSS or R. You know, you can do some of that to Power BI or Tableau. But these are the tools to really kind of understand the relationships between the data and use also apply multivariate analysis. I think that's also something that oftentimes researchers tend to sort of get stuck on, the kind of descriptive analytics of here's a cross step and here are the things that I'm seeing, the column percentages and row percentages, as opposed to trying to ask the question, well, what's the relationship between all these data points? And that's why you use more of the multivariate analysis. So tools like R and SPSS are really lending themselves to do that. So that's one category, the tools for exploration. And then there's the tools to essentially get the data, right, and collect the data, which is your survey programming tools or the tools that you have, or maybe the insights communities you've built. So a lot of companies nowadays build their own sort of in-house panels, if you will. But these are all kind of the sources and the techniques you use to get to the data. And it could also be a syndicated data practice. So sometimes we have someone who's fully dedicated to getting syndicated insights, so getting insights that are existing in the broader world. And then obviously the last sort of category is the tools to communicate your findings. So this could be a combination of the visualization tools, which can also be Power BI or Tableau, or the many other visualization tools out there, can sort of help you bring things a little bit more to life. We do a lot through audio and well and video clips, but those are those kinds of tools. And obviously just a traditional presentation and PowerPoint, which is still many organizations, the main way of communicating. And with that, there's a lot of pitfalls as well, but it's still kind of a way of communicating and getting a message across. And we've recently also started to do a lot more kind of like one-pagers and really try to force the researcher to really boil it down to the essence, as opposed to trying to hit up your stakeholders with 50, 60 pages of PowerPoint, right? And that by PowerPoint. So those are some of the things. And I think knowledge management is part of that as well. So obviously you have to organize and create this body of work so that you can tap into that at a later time and communicate your insights or go back to maybe prior work you've done so they can really kind of connect the dots and compare and contrast of how maybe these new findings compare to things you've done previously. And in some cases also kind of create benchmarks around when you do concept testing, is this actually a concept? How does this compare to a concept we tested 2 or 3 years ago? And is this potentially more powerful or less powerful? So those are the three categories, the tools for data exploration, data tools to get the data, and then tools to communicate your findings.
I think it's a very good way to structure that thinking. And of course, I'm a big believer in knowledge management. But before I ask more talent-focused questions, I'd love you to share a bit more about your book, The Business of Marketing Research, and its practical approach to market research. Who's the book aimed at, and why did you create it?
Yeah, so it's a book we wrote a few years ago now. And it was really geared towards students. So we really wanted to kind of create a textbook for the academic world for universities to adopt. We also built a number of course materials around it. But really the impetus for writing the book was, as we started to scan the landscape of what was out there, we felt like a lot of the books out there on market research tended to be very theoretical, but also not written, they weren't written around specific use cases. So they weren't written around real world problems that most organizations are being faced with. Like earlier on, I talked about, you know, the need to understand your loyalty with your customers or your satisfaction with your customers, the need as you get larger as an organization of what your brand positioning is and how do you do research around understanding how you build a strong brand architecture. Or, and so really kind of trying to marry the sort of dry techniques that you use in market research or in the insights profession to solve, using that to solve real world problems and make it much more applied. But there's a whole method around like product innovation and how do you use research to understand product innovation. And so we spent quite a bit of time talking about that in the book as well. And just making things, make it very clear in the book as well that it's not just about doing the research, but what's more importantly often is how do you communicate these findings and how do you tell stories around those findings. And so storytelling is a really big aspect of the book as well. And so it goes in great depth into that. And then lastly, we also felt like a lot of the textbooks were a bit outdated. Like I think the market research profession is much broader now than it is. The demands are much larger. You need to know a little bit about data science. You need to understand like how you write algorithms and how can you use algorithms to do, for example, a driver analysis or let it go beyond sort of traditional regression-based techniques. We also spend a lot of time covering neuroscience and neuromarketing, right? So there's a lot of advances in recent years around using neuroscience to understand how people make unconscious decisions about products or things that may be hard to explain in a survey, expressed through a survey. So we spent some time around that, particularly around the topic of like eye tracking, but also talking about ECG and other techniques that are being used in that space. And then obviously, we've seen a lot of advances in text analytics with natural language processing. And how do you, obviously, a lot of the information we're getting today is in unstructured format. So that requires research practitioners to pick up new skills to understand how you can use that to, or how can you use the unstructured data then to drive insights, categorize and classify that data in ways that was previously impossible to do with the technology we have today. So yeah, those are sort of the main topics that we covered in the book. And it was written by myself being kind of having spent most of my career in the client side. The other person, Marco Vinch, is coming from the academic world. And then Dao Rademacher, who is working on the vendor side. And so that blend and those mix of experiences, I think, created a really interesting book. And so far, yeah, we've sold it to universities, but you can also get it on Amazon. And yeah, that's kind of the impetus. And the people that are listening today, they can obtain it if you go to Cognella, the website that is the publisher. And if you search for the book and type in digging 35 as the code, then you get a 35% discount. So.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that. And we'll repeat it at the end of the show also. You talked about the balance of the authors that you had, one from academia, yourself as a practitioner, and also somebody on the agency side. And the balance, that's the balance of the authors of the book. But if we instead talk a bit more about the industry, we talk a bit about how do you believe that, what type of balance do you need for a successful insights team? What is the DNA of a successful insights team?
I'm a big believer of variety and range. Like I think I see this mistake being made in some instances as well, where people tend to like get uber focused on, I want everyone who has SQL experience or everyone has a deep technological experience, or I want everyone to be really good with communication and being able to manage up and you know, as long as they can sell very well, those are the people I want. And so you can't over-index on one type of individual too much, because then I think you're just not going to build as strong of a team. And I think the biggest team, the most successful teams have that variety of skill sets, whether it's okay to have some people who are really strong on methodology, some people who are maybe stronger on communication and organization or more technical. But that blend is really important. I do think that everyone needs to have some behavioral data orientation. So they need to understand kind of what's possible with big data and some data analytics, especially in this day and age. because I do believe that if you leverage multiple data sources and integrate them effectively, you come to better insights and stronger insights. I think we've recently just started to employ people that are almost at the cusp of like programming software engineers who can sort of automate and create sort of efficiency in the whole process so that we can move much faster, because speed is really important. And so how do you launch a survey to then get to insights very quickly? There's a lot of like technology automation that goes on behind the scenes that is an important part of how, I think, how I grow the team as well. But I'd say those are the things. And then obviously it goes down to like people need to be motivated and have the curiosity and creativity, which is also key to having a successful team.
And in your description of the book, you also highlighted how, you know, market research has changed. And so you implicitly also highlighted how different talents are brought to the table that weren't necessarily necessary, you know, 10, 20 years ago. If we talk more about the insights organization within the organization, what skills do you believe as essential to help elevate that insights team so it gets more visibility and exposure within the organization?
Obviously, we hit on the problem-solving skill sets and the ability to take a problem and really define what the problem is and then try to figure out like how you solve that problem. I think that's kind of a non-negotiable to me. I think the other areas I'd say is like you need people who can really synthesize and connect the dots across a number of data sets and be able to see what the patterns are. I think that's really important. But ultimately, I think communication skills and the ability to tell stories is going to be fundamental to then getting the insights across in your organization to get people to internalize it. What's for me personally been really helpful is that I've played a lot of different roles. In some cases, I've been at the receiving end of research, and sometimes I've been obviously the producer of research, if you will. But having seen all the different sort of vantage points helps you build more of an appreciation of actually what you need to deliver for your stakeholders so that they can take action on it. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, I believe in the three C's, which is creativity, curiosity, and conviction. And I think that's really important. That last point is particularly around conviction. You need to be confident about what you're seeing in the data, and you need to be able then to get the organization to really act on it. That requires some conviction. Where I see a lot of researchers being maybe they're holding back too much, or they're too conservative, or they sort of undermine themselves by saying, well, I think it may mean this, but standing up and saying, no, it means this, we need to do these three things, I think shifts the bounds of how the organization should act on it and drive more urgency around it. So
I really like the fact that you highlight conviction, because it doesn't actually often come up. But many insights leaders that I talk to talk about, you know, the so what question. You bring up data and people say, hey, so what? And you've talked about it too. But I think conviction really helps you break through that barrier. So you should do these things. And talking a bit more about opportunities to do business impact, and you've already shared the story of how you at LinkedIn were facing this misconception from the market that, you know, LinkedIn was only for large enterprises. And there were actually a big opportunity to build product for SMB, which you did successfully. But if we look at the future ahead of us today, what opportunities do you think there are for insights professionals to make true business impact and to challenge the status quo?
Yeah, I mean, I think too many groups, and we are certainly at fault of this as well, we're not independent enough to ask sort of the question that we think we should be asking, but rather we're asking the question that the organization is asking us to ask. But the problem in that is that a lot of the research you then end up doing is basically becoming just trying to confirm what the organization has already decided they were going to do, and then try to sort of find the data after the fact that supports their decision. And I think that's a very risky path to be on. It creates massive path dependence, because you're then just executing research to sponsor whatever the agenda is of the executive. But I think the research groups that are most successful are the ones that have a healthy balance of time that they're spending on truly asking the more foundational and fundamental questions of why does this business exist? Who are our customers really? Or what do our customers really want from us? And so you need to go out there and ask some of these bigger questions. You can't just ask what others are asking you to ask. And so I think that's going to get you ultimately to the real truths. And so there needs to be healthy balance of things that are self-initiated Because every time when we do this, and I make sure that there's always some buffer of things that we initiate, you always come back with very powerful insights that then really start to challenge the status quo. Because you know the status quo is the status quo, and people will ask questions to just confirm the status quo versus, and there's massive confirmation bias, there's massive sort of cherry picking happening in their realm. But this requires a certain amount of confidence in your team, in your abilities. But it also requires you to have these really strong relationships with your partners so that they trust you, that when you come back with something that is maybe a little bit uncomfortable for them to hear, that they trust that you've done all the due diligence and that it is an insight they should be acting on. And that may be something very different that wasn't on their agenda or the roadmap, but they need to face that in order to be successful. And so that's how you break down some of the path dependencies that maybe the organization has created. But it's not easy. I mean, I'll be the first to admit it. I can't tell you how often I see just people taking the report and then just picking only the things that support the agenda versus and then ignoring or dismissing or putting aside the things that are maybe a little bit more inconvenient and uncomfortable.
I think that's such good advice. And I think that it resonates really well with what you said before also, namely the fact that a lot of research fails because we're failing to understand the problem we're trying to solve, right? So it's like, right. I think it ties really nicely to that. Rukir, unfortunately, we're getting close to the end of this conversation, yeah. But I have one last question for you. And that is, who in the world of insights would you love to have lunch with?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the world of insights, I was thinking about this. I mean, it's a hard question because the world of insight is vast. Like, there's lots of people there's lots of companies that are acting in the insights industry, a lot of money in the industry around insights. Ultimately, that drives knowledge and that drives powers economies, that powers innovation, etc. And so this maybe sounds strange to you, but I would love to talk to Mark Zuckerberg. So, and the reason I want to talk to him is because I just don't understand why he has such strong conviction around the metaverse as being the next evolution of the platform that Facebook should be, or Meta should be building. And I'm really curious to hear from him, like, where is that conviction coming from? Like, what is he seeing that I'm not seeing, or others maybe are not seeing, that makes him believe that we all end up in a metaverse, or that we all should be spending a lot of time in a metaverse? And so I'm really scratching my head. I mean, this may be a little bit off, like a weird answer. You may have not expected this, but this is just one that I'm just really recently just real struggling with.
I love the answer. And I promise you, when you have that lunch, I will be on the table next door because I'm equally as interested in that answer as you are. So, wow, this has been such an inspiring conversation, Rukir. And I think it's always amazing to hear about how you and how LinkedIn are driving more insights-driven decisions across the organization. And maybe you could remind our audience about the book and the discount code.
Yeah, so you can get the book on Cognella. So Cognella's website is the publisher. Search for Business of Marketing Research. And then as you order the book, you can enter the code DIGGING35. So DIGGING35, all capital. And that will give you then a 35% discount. Always happy to, people want to ping me, they didn't get it, or there's some issues, just let me know.
Massive. And I know that I've learned a lot from talking to you today. Just playing some of it back, I think that I'm just fascinating what you have done, LinkedIn, you know, the groundbreaking understanding you have brought to the world, insights that have helped you understand the graphs, but also helped us understand how companies and where companies get talent, how companies and where companies lose talent to, and where the world's talent is located. That was simply not possible before you brought it to the world. In terms of learnings and things we and the audience can bring with us, I think what you said about how a lot of research fails because we actually fail to understand the problem we are solving and to spend more time on that. What do we know? And what exactly are we trying to solve for? As advice for all of us, as we do this, be more confident. Thank you so much. I'm sure our audience has enjoyed this as much as I have. Thank you so much for joining me today, Rukir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
The Consumer Insights
Consumer Insights Podcast is brought to you by Stravito, the user-friendly enterprise insights platform. To find out more about Stravito, visit stravito.com and make sure to search for Consumer Insights in Apple, Google, Spotify, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Click follow so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Stravito, thank you for listening.